I want to turn it over to our guest from Museum of Science. This is Anna
Lindgren-Stryker. So there are three of us right now. There will be four of us shortly from the Museum of Science who work with Nora there. What we have today, we're working on a prototype of a touchscreen-based computer interactive that we want to design to be fully accessible for all users. So we have a very early prototype of that that we want to share with you today to get your feedback, to see if there are any other sources of inspiration that all of you know about that we should be looking at as we move forward in the design. We figure this is an excellent expert user group that could give us early feedback on the direction we're thinking about as we really move into the guts of the hard design here.
Hi, I'm Caroline Angel Burke. I'm a project manager in the exhibits department at the Museum of Science. So today I'll give you a little bit of background about the big gallery project that's really the context for this interface that we'll be presenting.
I'm Keith Simmons, and I'm an interactive software developer working with the Hall of Human Life at the museum. And I asked if I could come along today just to listen in on some of the concerns and design implications that could go into future prototypes.
And hopefully Ben Wilson will be pulling up shortly.
So I figured I'd start out just by talking a little bit about the history of this project and some accessibility work we've done in the past at the Museum of Science and some of the constraints that are unique to the museum environment. The Museum of Science accessibility efforts started over 25 years ago in the exhibits department, and originally we started out as a natural history museum, so we had lots of dioramas behind glass, which is really not ideal for a large number of museum visitors. So when we first started doing accessibility work, it was really with a universal design bent, and we found that that's a great approach for the museum environment. We never know who's going to walk through our doors, and so we want to have our exhibits out on the floors ready for anyone. Also, we have about 1.5, 1.7 million visitors a year, so just the logistics of handing out assistive technologies or things like that at the front desk get pretty difficult, so that's why we really try to do a universal design approach to build in accessibility into our exhibits themselves when the exhibits are first built. When we started 25 years ago, there were not a lot of computer-based interactives in museums in general, so a lot of our efforts were focused on mechanical and tactile interactives in museums and trying to make those accessible to a wide audience. That was sort of our first push, and then museum exhibits started incorporating a lot more computer interactives as well. So about 10, 12 years ago, we started developing a computer-based interface that was controlled with a tactile button interface, and that's really what we've been using up until the present, really, was a computer interface with these tactile buttons that allowed you to navigate through. There was audio that you could turn on and off to navigate through. We did extensive user testing, continue to do it in every iteration, and that's sort of become our standard for computer-based interactives in our exhibit halls. However, we are moving into the 21st century. No, we're solidly in the 21st century, and we're trying to move our computer technology along with it as well. And there's been a big push in a lot of museum exhibits to move to a touchscreen-based interactive, which we know there are challenges with having a touchscreen-based interactive. So what we've started to do with our current project is we're in the early stages of thinking about what does it mean to have a universally designed touchscreen in a museum exhibit, which there are lots of challenges surrounding that. For example, as I mentioned, we want to try to design it so there's no assistive technology that has to get handed out or plugged in when you approach the kiosk, just because everyone brings different devices with them to the museum, and the logistics of handing out assistive technologies when you get your tickets and things like that gets really difficult with our visitor volume. It needs to be really robust with those 1.7 million visitors a year. A lot of them are kids that like to try to break things, not intentionally, just, you know, testing the capacity of things, right? And obviously we're in a museum environment. People spend an average of a minute or and a half or 2 minutes at each exhibit, so it needs to be something that's really intuitive to figure out to use, or if you spend 15, 30 seconds figuring out how to use it the first time, we can implement it in the same way across an entire exhibit, so you only have to spend that 30 seconds once. And then you know how to use it across multiple different exhibits. So those are some of the challenges that we're trying to work with when thinking about this touchscreen and what it'll look like and how it will work. As I mentioned, this is really in the early stages. This is the first version. This is version zero of the prototype. So, you know, things like we're going to be adding in audio voiceover text, but for today we'll just be acting as the audio voiceover text ourselves and reading it aloud because we haven't recorded voice yet. We want to get a first pass from all of you about the direction we've chosen to take, what you think of it, and if there are any other places that we should be looking for inspiration, people who are doing good work in this area that we should do some research on to get ideas from. So I'll kick it over to Caroline, who will talk a little bit about the specific exhibit that this prototype is going to be developed in.
So the Hall of Human Life is a 10,000 square foot gallery project that the Museum of Science has been developing now for about 3 or 4 years. It's sort of been bubbling under the surface for quite some time. And its real sort of main messages are that humans are changing in a changing environment. And one of the ways that we hope visitors will kind of interact with those messages is by providing their own measurements at a variety of different measurement stations. So everyone is basically contributing their own data and therefore creating a large data set that we can learn from and that we can sort of see how humans are changing in a changing environment. For the most part, most of these measurements, we have been able to sort of plug them into our standard UD3 button interactive interface, which means that, as Anna was saying, that you know, we're not presenting visitors with an additional challenge of figuring out how to use the interactive. We think the content sometimes can be challenging enough. We don't want to be putting an extra barrier in place by creating an interface that's difficult to use. So for the most part, we feel like we've done a pretty good job of at least keeping to a pretty standard interface that works well with lots of different input devices that can display things in a variety of different ways. There is, however, a portion of the exhibit called provocative questions. And this is an area where we're asking visitors to think about socio-scientific argumentation, which is quite a mouthful to have to say, and it's quite challenging to get people to think about. Basically, socio-scientific issues are issues that science can contribute understanding to, but can't tell you what's the right answer for you, what's the right choice for you. We're testing at the moment with the question, should sugary drinks be taxed? That's a question that has broad societal implications. We're talking about taxing or restrictions or availability, but it's an individual choice and it's based on individual choices too. So in this case, we're basically getting visitors to think about these big topics where they bring not only sort of scientific evidence, and in this particular question, you could look at studies to do with, has taxation changed behavior in the past? What do sugary drinks do to us? And we found that there's always going to be scientific evidence that's on both sides of these questions. But people also bring other things to the table too, like your own personal values and your personal experience. And so this mixture of these three elements, your personal experience, your values, and scientific evidence that you find compelling, ends up helping to support your own personal position on any socio-scientific issue. These provocative questions are, very much in the public mind now. I mean, there's lots of these things bubbling around. And they're also kind of challenging to kind of come to grips with. We're science museum, obviously, and we want to show that science has a voice and can contribute something to these discussions, but we also know that people have these other elements that they bring to the conversation. So really what we want to do is to promote, in an unfacilitated exhibit, these types of conversations. We've been working quite hard for a couple of years now trying to figure out how do we do this. We've kind of isolated it to a couple of different steps. One, just introducing what's the question at hand. What are some of the values that you might bring to the table? What are some of the personal experiences you might have? What's the scientific evidence that we can call on to be able to contribute to these discussions? And then we want to have an interactive, facilitate a conversation between two people. If a visitor and a partner come to the museum, they can sit down at what we're hoping will be an accessible touchscreen component. In this component, a visitor will be able to...
So they'll sit down at an unfacilitated exhibit and be able to hear a little bit more about the background of the question, choose their own personal values, talk a little bit about their own personal experiences, look at some scientific evidence, and essentially create this socio-scientific argument that includes scientific evidence, values, and personal experiences, and then, answer the question, should sugary drinks be taxed? Yes, no, I don't know, I'm totally indifferent. That's the sort of educational goal and educational approach to the activity specifically that we're working on. So we're looking at a lot of questions that have health-related implications. So, for example, example, the taxing of sugary drinks. You know, drinking lots of sugary drinks has impacts on diabetes, obesity, lots of other health issues. So we talk some about that, but then also leave room for people to talk about their values and their personal experiences with it, which actually has been really interesting as we've started to test out the activity. I wanted to ask all of you a few questions just to help us think in our further development. Are there any really great accessible touchscreen designs that we should be looking at? So for those of you who do have iPhones, iPads, the Apple devices, what really works for you about that interface? What is it that you like that has made it good for you?
Consistent.
What don't you like?
Yeah, and also what don't you like, absolutely.
I mean, it's really only one of the only one touchscreen devices that is accessible.
It's accessible, but then I can also quickly put it in a mode where somebody who doesn't need the voiceover can use it.
This really preserves the spatial layout of the screen. Mm-hmm. So that for the first time in my experience, when my daughter got an iPhone and she's fully sighted, I was able to tell her where things were on the screen and help her to get oriented, because Apple in its implementation with VoiceOver has maintained that integrity so that where the placement of things on the screen spatially is mm-hmm. important. And it also just helps with muscle memory. When I'm doing things and when I'm walking down the street with the cane in one hand and my phone in my pocket or my phone in my other hand, and I'm using my thumb to do muscle memory, and that spatial orientation of the screen really makes a big difference.
The idea that you can get any third-party, well, most third-party apps, and you don't have to specifically design each of those apps so that they'll work with the screen. I mean, they make it consistent so that you have access to, you know, all these different third-party applications.
I've tried touchscreen. I think Apple has done a wonderful job with the VoiceOver and preserving the integrity of the screen, but I don't like to rely on muscle memory. I want to have buttons that I know when I push it, it's going to be right, and not have to, particularly making a phone call. I can't do that on touchscreen. I like my simple phone that I have buttons for. So even though I'd love to have the apps, I'm not willing to sacrifice the uncertainty to get all those.
I think sometimes when it comes to speed, when there's something like dialing a phone or you know, anything that, the advantage with the touchscreen is, yes, the spatial layout is preserved, and that can be beneficial for a lot of different apps. When you have a screen where things are constantly changing, the position of things are changing, I feel like a touchscreen can be very beneficial. On the other hand, with something like a phone, where things are consistently you know, in the same place, and when you have buttons that you know usually close together, even typing when you have a keyboard, with, you know anything where you have a bunch of you know small buttons, whether they're virtual or real, I think that's when something with physical buttons can be a lot easier, is because you can just be a lot quicker.
One of the issues that made some of the early devices, even some of the current devices, really confusing visually, is that the interfaces were very inconsistent. You could be using one item and it works one way, next item and it's completely different. I think with Apple, they kind of moved in a direction where they're kind of looking towards pushing the developers of third-party apps to remain very consistent in what they actually do. As far as you'll see in a lot of programs, there'll be control buttons on the top of the screen and on the bottom, and then most of the content is actually in the middle. That's a very consistent type of interface. Mm-hmm. That's true, you know, whether not using a GPS program or a word processing program, or even something from Apple itself. One of the reasons why UI devices have been so popular with people who are blind is that they kind of win by default, almost.
I had a previous phone with a touchscreen interface that where I loaded and bought a third-party application, a MobileSpeak Pocket from Code Factory, and I loaded that on, and I was still using a touchscreen. I wasn't using buttons. But the difference was, A, I had to pay extra for that program, and B, although it was interactive, it was quite complex to use, and it also didn't maintain that spatial integrity, so no sighted person who picked up my phone would have at least understanding of how to use it.
Absolutely. I mean, I've used MobileSpeak Pocket, and what it did was it actually reinterpreted the screen as there was four quadrants, and each quadrant was essentially a button. So say if you wanted to activate a menu, you could do a single tap on quadrant one or a single long tap. You were never actually physically tapping any of the items on the screen.
Right.
Whereas with the Apple approach, what it is that you physically walk around the screen and you're interacting with the same layout as someone who's looking at a sighted.
Now, one thing I will say that I wish could be done a little better with the iDevices, particularly with third-party apps. I do think that there are times when it would be help it would be helpful to have a help button. Sometimes when exploring apps initially, exploring new programs initially, it would be helpful to have some help information. And a lot of app developers don't do that and don't build it in. I happen to be working with Major League Baseball on their app, and that's been one of the suggestions I made to them, because their app in particular is not one that is always intuitive in terms of the way in which you use it. And the lack of help in terms of orientation to, I think is a deficit, but sometimes.
I know early in the development of iOS, there was a design guideline that if you need a help function in the interface, it's not properly designed.
The challenge for you is you work with the iPhone and there's a learning curve to learning that. Your situation, someone's going to have to learn to use this quickly. So there has to be sort of a basic instruction beforehand in terms of how the screen, because you go up to a screen, you have no idea where to start.
If you want a good example of that, go up to a talking ATM and plug a earpiece into it and listen to the initial instructions. They do a great job of doing this. The first thing they do is they give you a very quick tour of the machine. They tell you the keypad is stuff in front of you, the slot for your card is up and to the right, about 7 inches, and they just give you exactly what you need to know, nothing more. Then they start you by saying, well, to pick the function you want with by pressing the arrow keys or something like that, whatever it is, but they give it,
like the voiceover, when you first turn the voiceover on, then you get a few instructions, just very, very few instructions how to actually use it. You know, double tap when you want this, and you know, then you may not know everything, but you have a beginning.
I'm a volunteer in the accessibility program of the Museum of Fine Arts, and one thing is people shouldn't go too gaga over technology, because the best part of a museum visit, if you're visually impaired, I think, is the human interaction you have with a guide, who's a good guide. So technology can be an interesting adjunct, an interesting little add-on, but it's not going to work as the centerpiece of a tour for most blind people, unless they have a good amount of usable vision so they can go all over the place themselves.
There's the option at our institution to have, you know, sort of a custom sighted guide tour doing whatever you want to do around the institution. I mean, most visitors who come in are guiding themselves around the institution, ending up where they want to go. So the idea is this would be something that you could use independently.
Yeah, and I would say I do think that that's important, because as a parent, one of the frustrations that I sometimes had when I took my kids when they were younger to the museum was that I really couldn't access some of the information, and because I couldn't access some of the information, it was hard for me to be helpful to them. There are times when certainly a guided tour is really helpful and enriching, but I do like the option of being able to go up myself, do something at my leisure, and do it independently.
If I were to walk up to a touch screen not knowing anything about it, my first reaction would be to touch the upper left-hand corner where you would start reading about the screen.
And one of the things that I find very, very irritating about many touchscreen products is that you put your finger on that and all of a sudden stuff starts happening and you don't know why it's happening. You don't even know what you did. So I think a very important component of any touchscreen that you do is you give people a way to explore the screen without making things happen until they're actually ready to make things happen. Right. And a very clear understanding of what they have to do to make something happen. Because one of the great things about buttons that is not true of a touchscreen is that until you actually push the button, nothing happens. So it gives you plenty of time to kind of walk around the screen and explore it with your fingers. And I find that I use the positioning of the buttons to give myself information about the screen itself. And I find that many times is missing from a touchscreen.
If the person's going to be using a headset, for example, or an earphone, that once they plug in that earphone, the instructions automatically begin.
And you could even have it so that the first time you put your finger on any part of that screen, instead of doing anything that the buttons would normally do, it triggers the help.
When we developed our three-button interface, we've managed to, you know, there's certain decision points and activities that you do at a computer kiosk. And for the most part, that three-button interface helps you to negotiate those content screens, whether the content is about archaeology and dinosaurs, or whether it's an activity that you're sort of building on for engineering, or a whole variety of different things. And so in some ways, yes, this is a specific specific case, but we're hoping that the touchscreen interface is really something that we would be able to apply in a bunch of different exhibit experiences at the museum. You know, we'll test it out in this particular scenario, but we're hoping that the knowledge that we're gaining by working on this one particular project will be able to be applicable across the floor.
As far as the content, what are you asking the person at the kiosk to do? Are you asking him to type in things? Are you asking him just to say yes, no, or pick from a list?
We definitely are not asking for typing. What we're asking visitors to do is basically choose from a limited menu of options. In one case, there's 6 values we're asking visitors to choose from, and then there's 9 different pieces of scientific evidence we're asking visitors to choose from, broken into 3 categories.
Are they entering the data, though, the actual numbers?
They're selecting. They're not entering.
Yeah. Is the selections in columns or rows, or are they just...
We're still figuring that out.
How are we going to find the damn thing?
We know. That's an excellent question that we struggle with on a daily basis at the Museum of Science. Nora can probably vouch for this better than anyone.
But again, the vast majority of blind people who go and visit a museum, they go with somebody sighted. Okay, so that's just something to keep in mind. There might be 1% who... are adventurous enough to plow in there all on their own, but that's not the majority of people.
Higher than that.
I mean, a sighted person, unless they've read up on the museum, may not know what these exhibits are.
Yeah. I actually didn't mention this when I introduced myself. I'm actually in our evaluation department, and that's actually running that user testing is a big chunk of what I do. So we're definitely taking that process really seriously, and we're hoping that all of you can sort of serve as our first round for the version 0 of this particular prototype. So the plan is that we'll continue to test that. I'll kick it out to Ben, who is the one who's developing this magical device, who will introduce a little bit more.
So my name is Ben Wilson, and I'm the software development supervisor in the Information and Interactive Technologies team at the Museum of Science. And what this first phase prototype that we're talking about here is, even before what we would generally prototype with the public and involving Anna's group, this is real proof of concept. We just wanted to, before investing a lot of it, time and development resources into fleshing this out, we wanted to get some initial feedback, especially from this group, if even this direction is something that seems appropriate before even continuing with it into our formal evaluation and prototype iteration process. What this prototype really is a completely bare-bones sort of framework idea. It's a big touchscreen. It's 19 inches on the diagonal, which is about standard for a lot of the touchscreens that are produced and used in museums for this time. It's been something that, in the past, there hasn't been a really good way of using this in a really universal design method. The focus of this is about divorcing the input from any location on the screen, so it's purely gesture-based. It doesn't matter where you touch the screen as long as the gesture is correct. And gestures are tricky, so this being a very early prototype, it may not do exactly as anticipated, but with fine-tuning, they are actually very accurate. The essential idea is that you can swipe in one of 4 directions any place on the screen, and that will navigate based on enunciated cues at any point. So it follows the particular process for this building your argument or case interactive, which is just step-by-step walking through a number of processes about personal experience, about scientific evidence, and then about social values, and then ultimately whether yes, no, or you just have no idea whether or not sugary drinks should be taxed.
Oh, I'll volunteer.
What if someone cannot do any of these gestures? Are you guys considering the use of switches, etc., for people who cannot do any of these primary...
Yeah, we're certainly considering sort of physical accessibility with mobility as well. What we try to do is make it so that all of the interaction can happen very close, if you want to, very close to the edge of the screen, which is right on, we put the screen's edge right up against the table so that there's minimal reach and physical effort required to use it. So that's the general design approach that we take with all of our physical interactives. Maybe we can send a couple people towards the back of the room. We already have our first volunteer towards the back of the room. We haven't done the voice recording yet, so Ben is going to be doing the voiceover himself with the idea that recording takes time and money to do. So since it's such an early prototype,
would it be helpful to, or would it defeat the purpose if we heard somebody go through it?
Yeah. Right, that's what I was the first person.
Yeah, well, if you're volunteering to be the first person to go through it, we'll... Lisa, do you go through it? And
so the screen is inset inside a wooden frame. This is just a real simple prototype casing that we have. So I'll start reading the text on the screen, and it should be apparent what the instructions are.
Through is that. The screen at an angle?
Yes, it is.
What angle?
45 degrees. Should there be a tax on sugary drinks? This is a social issue that can be informed but not answered by science. There's not a correct answer to this question. Before you decide yes or no about taxing sugary drinks, stop and consider the following. Your personal experience with this topic, current science regarding sugary drinks, your social values, convictions about how society should work. To continue, swipe right on the touchscreen. Step one, personal experience. Personal experience includes the experiences and observations we make throughout our lifetime as well as common knowledge. During this part of the activity, we will ask visitors to think about their personal experience with this issue, then discuss their experience with a partner. For the purposes of this single participant demonstration, we will skip this step. To continue, swipe right on the touchscreen. Step two, scientific evidence. Scientific evidence refers to studies that have been conducted using the scientific method and can conflict, change, and be complex. During this part of the activity, we will explore a series of scientific studies related to this topic and select one study that will best help you build your case. To continue, swipe right on the question. Study 1 of 9. Do sugary drinks contribute to weight gain, diabetes, and hypertension? To read this study, swipe down. To cycle through the studies, swipe right or left. Study 9 of 9. Do artificial sweeteners contribute to weight gain? Version 2. To read this study, swipe down. To cycle through the studies, swipe right or left. Study 8 of 9. Do artificial sweeteners cause cancer? To read this study, swipe down. To this content has not been completed. To spare further hunting and pecking, now I'm taking my voice out of the interactive. Study 1 of 9 is the only one there is text for right now. But
now, I just swiped left.
You swipe left to back up.
So back up, and you need to tell me where I am.
So you're at study 1 of 9. It continues to cycle through all the pieces, typically through evaluations. We let people fail a few times to see where we need to do work. So we're at study 9 of 9.
I gotta go to the left, right?
To the right will take you to 1 because we'll cycle through all of them.
Oh, because it'll go back to 8. It does wrap.
So study 1 of 9. Down. So the screen. How do taxes impact the consumption of sugary drinks? Sales of sugary drinks declined during the price increase phase. Educational programs, along with the price increase, had greater impact. Educational programs alone did not show an effect. Who did the study? Anindya Sen from the University of Waterloo in Ontario was one author of a paper published in the Health Policy Journal in October of 2010. How was the research conducted? This study compared data from the eastern and western Canada to estimate effects of higher cigarette taxes in one region as recorded in Canadian Community Health Surveys in 2003 and 2005. To add this study to your case, swipe down. To return to the study selection, swipe left. You have selected the study investigating how taxes impact the consumption of sugary drinks from the University of Waterloo. To continue, swipe right. To choose a different study, swipe left.
This question, I thought I heard you say cigarettes.
The research was done on cigarette taxation in that particular case. So at this point, it did not catch your input on that. So try swiping right one more time. There we go. Step 3, social values. Social values are the deeply held convictions that guide each person's feelings and decisions about social issues. During this part of the activity, you will explore a series of common social values and select one study that will best help build your case. To continue, swipe right on the touchscreen.
We only have one study here as well.
No, actually, we have value 1 of 6, and all 6 are represented. A healthy individual shouldn't have to pay for other people's health problems. To select this value, swipe down. To cycle through values, swipe right or left. Did not read that input. Value 2 of 6. A person should be free to choose whatever they want to eat or drink, whatever the health consequences. To select this value, swipe down. To cycle through the values, swipe. Did not read your input. Value 3 of 6. We should be wary of what manufacturers are putting in food. To select this value, swipe down. To cycle through values, swipe right or left. Value 4 of 6. All members of a community should share in the expenses for maintaining health in the community. Value 5 of 6. The government should take care of potential health problems like this and enforce restraints on what people choose to eat or drink. To select this value, swipe down. Value 6 of 6. We should have confidence in government regulations and trust food and drink are available in markets today. Select this value, swipe down.
So when you select a value, does that mean, it doesn't mean you're necessarily supporting that value, it means you make a choice about it once you've selected it, right?
The intention is that this would be the one that best supports the case that you were building.
Oh, okay.
Any time, right now, we're just in the phase of cycling through them, and I've been selected. So your value 3 of 6, we should be wary of what manufacturers are putting in food. To select this value, swipe down, to cycle through values, swipe right or left. It didn't read that either. And again, it didn't. And then 2 of 6.
Can you select more than one?
No. In this particular iteration, no.
Because you wouldn't really know. And then also, you might want to have a way of knowing what you have selected. Because I wasn't sure. Maybe she could pick a couple of them there.
Yeah, we haven't gone through the selection as of yet in this process. There will be an opportunity for review in the final process as well. You're a value 2 of 6. A person should be free to choose whatever they want to eat or drink, whatever the health consequences. To select this value, swipe down. 3 of 6, 4 of 6. All members of the community should share in the expenses for maintaining health in the community. Sue, select this value, swipe down. Did not read your input there. Value 5 of 6. The government should take care of potential health problems like this and enforce restrictions if people choose to eat or drink. Just select this value, swipe down, recycle through values, right.
That's why I want to select any of them.
And I should say we're still testing, in addition to figuring out this interface, we're still in the process of testing out the content to see if we can get values and experiences that, so if anyone who sits down and finds something that they are interested in selecting.
To select it, swiping down is currently what we use. We could explore tapping as an option for that as well. And anytime you input, it jumps to the next screen as long as it reads that, so you don't have to listen to it read the whole piece. If you've already heard it, you can just quickly cycle to the next one and it'll immediately start reading the next screen. So we've moved on to step 4, make your comment. You can pause for the comment.
Once she selected an item, does that preclude her from selecting another item now locked out of that?
We are just, this is actually part of the content we're still testing about how many items we're going to allow people to select in each category and how far back into your decision-making you want to go history-wise. Within this particular way of doing it, using, say, an op gesture or something like that to navigate higher into the hierarchy of choices you've already made. It's not implemented in this version, but it's certainly a possibility. The whole idea behind building the socio-scientific argumentation and keeping it very simple, we're having a lot of internal discussions and a lot of testing about how many choices to give versus, because obviously it's tough to capture in a very...
But you could make a mistake. In the one that you accidentally swipe the wrong way, which is sometimes with all
I think a review would be helpful so that you could, if you could do a gesture that would review what you've done, so you always know where you are.
There is a way to hear all the choices before you decide which one, if you're going to be able to choose one.
Yes.
There's one screen that lists all 6 choices on one screen.
Yes.
Yeah, that's actually right now the up gesture, I just for the sake of this demonstration, restart the way you do that. It's like a lot of people through, but that was one of the things that very much was on my mind to test with the up gesture is where you are right now, status,
and
providing options to jump to different parts of the experience from that.
So now I'm at step 4.
Step 4 is make your claim. Should sugary drinks be taxed? For yes, swipe right. For no, swipe left. For undecided, swipe down.
Now, is there a gesture to repeat the audio?
That is also, my intent also with that up gesture was that to provide options for repeat status. That's sort of the contextual menu that jumps you to all sort of the user interface housekeeping ideas.
Are there any other, so we've talked about status and repeat screen. Are there any sort of other housekeeping menu items that you think we should have?
The speed of the voice, because it could really drive you crazy if it was... Yeah. Very slow, especially since there's a lot to go through here.
Yeah.
And the volume and the privacy screen.
Unless you're going to have a situation where they plug in a headphone or a headset, I assume you're going to have that as opposed to a...
We're planning right now about to have directional speakers, so we're working with audio engineer people.
Even within a noisy environment.
It won't be too noisy with a million up and going at the same time.
That's what we're trying to make sure doesn't happen. We're investigating. There are various...
I think audio is a big challenge in any museum environment. And so throughout all of the Hall of Human Life, we're kind of trying to tackle it. So in these cases, probably the default is not to have the audio on. So most users may not, or some users may not want the audio on. And so that will cut down on sort of having a lot of that audio combo jumbo kind of, you know, bouncing off the
I really would want a headphone option. I just want to say that, both because then I can make sure I could hear what I wanted to hear and needed to hear, because, you know, I mean, any kind of crowded environment is noisy.
Yeah.
And secondly, just so not to either interfere with other patrons who are maybe in the screen next to me, and also just for privacy. You said on a couple of occasions, it didn't take my gesture even though I did it. Now, I can think of a couple of times when I think I just did it too quickly, but there were a few cases when I felt like I did it the exact same way the first and second time, and it worked one and not the other.
Primarily, this is a fine-tuning issue of the calibration of the monitor and of the software itself.
You need to tell the user when the action has taken, or give them some sense of what to do if nothing happens. That way, they are sure they swipe right and nothing happens. They need to know, okay, maybe I wait a few seconds, I should do it over because it didn't work. There needs to be some feedback about
the noise, like a sound or something. That's one implementation that's a part of the iPhone that I think is helpful, in that, for example, when something is activated, it does make a sound, and that's helpful.
Well, if it doesn't activate, it makes a different sound.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you have an estimate of how much time it takes to go through this cycle? Because this is one of those examples where you have to look at all six choices before you make a decision. You can't shortcut your way out of this.
Mm-hmm.
So how long do you think it would take the average person to explore the six choices and then select one?
We have.
Visitors using sort of flip cards and pages to go through the activity. It took usually around 9 or 10 minutes, I remember them saying, kind of on average.
Which is really quite long for me to know.
And there's also conversation going on at the same time.
This is, I guess, one of the real important notes about this prototype is we basically cut out what is essentially all of the main point of it, which is interacting with the person across from you, who also has a similar experience. They're going through building their case, and at various points there are prompts to stop and discuss based on what you've just experienced. Really, this is just sort of a framework for building a case that you would then discuss from the person across you who also is at a station.
Can you also interrupt the, say you're going through the choices, and you know, you don't want to necessarily have to hear them decide to flip, you know, to go to the next choice, plus left, you know, swipe left. Can you, when it's giving those instructions, can you just swipe left and it will just, like what you would do, it will just go to the next choice?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we are planning on compiling the data and having some way, we're not exactly sure what that will look like, for you to be able to explore that. And the other thing about this particular activity is we're planning on having this be, the content be updatable and rotate through. So every 6 months or a year, we'll have a new provocative question on a new topic that might be more current to the news. So as different scientific issues or issues that could be related to or informed by science come up in the news, we can have things that are actually current and relevant that the content rotates through this particular activity, so it'll be something that's dynamic and changing.
This is all anonymously taken data, so we're not asking for your name.
What do you do with the data after you've collected it after a long period of time?
Well, when it comes to provocative questions, we don't have an outlet for this data yet. I mean, so far, what we probably will be doing is, after you go through the discussion process with somebody who's through this interface, and after there's another activity where we give people the chance to sort of reflect on the choices that they've made and to see any, you know, are there any contradictions or interesting topics that came up in that building activity. Then we will show, you know, how your choices compare to other people's choices that have used the exhibit. So to sort of let you see how there's both a diversity and how people build their particular arguments, and also connections between the software and the visitors.
And does the swipe up function also have a start from the beginning?
We have two things that we employ across the museum for that, which is a tactile button for starting over that is consistently shaped in size, as well, which then requires confirmation if that's what you really want to do once it's been pressed. And we also have a timeout if it's been idle for X number of minutes. On this particular piece, it's probably going to be a fairly long timeout because there's a lot of reading and digesting of information involved, but you know, it wouldn't sit there for 30 minutes and be at the same screen somewhere.
And one of the things we do know is important with the timeout is to give both an audio and visual cue that the museum, that the computer is about to time out. So if you don't want it to time out, you can cue it not to.
Oh, the start over is a tactile button that is right next to the monitor, and it's in a consistent location across the entire part of this exhibit. All that's on this screen is the text that's being read.
Oh, and how will someone know that the audio option is there and activate that?
That's consistent museum-wide with an activation button for the audio.
But they can't see that it's there.
I think that's a challenge that we're working on at the museum, because we have it across all of our galleries. We have an audio option that you can turn on and a hear phone that will give you some basic navigation as to what's actually in front of you. But actually communicating that to visitors when they first arrive that, yes, it's always on the left-hand side. You can turn the audio button on with a 1-inch square button on the left-hand side of any exhibit. You know, part of that is staff training to get the folks on the front lines who are initially directing people into the museum to do that. So once someone knows it is there, it's consistent throughout the museum, and we're working on ways that's communicated to people as they come in. For the audio labels, it's just a single activation button to start it or restart it.
You have walking audio tapes, audio assistants?
We do not. We've occasionally had them for specific exhibits, but we don't have one throughout the museum.
Do you have a resource for, say, a blind person? Maybe it's a little off topic. If a blind person, say, comes into a museum and wants to know all the exhibits that they are there, do you have some kind of, you know, an audio or some sort of way that they can be able to walk around and know what exhibits they can get to? Or, you know, like a database of them that they can look at?
Lindsay, what we do have is a list of exhibits that have non-visual elements. Whether it's audio, olfactory, that you sort of need to get ahead of time. The biggest challenge about the Museum of Science is wayfinding. It's a large cavern.
Yes, I've been there once.
And unlike art museums, there are no organized tours or tour guides. There are no pre-recorded audio tours that one can follow from place to place to place. But there are employees and volunteers trained as sighted guides. The best thing to do is to make a request for that in advance.
It just seems like it would be at least having something where somebody can, whether it's a book or whatever, where someone can, you know, have some kind of ideas for what they want to do, like on each floor, yeah, you know, what there is to do.
A director.
Yeah, like a director.
Available on the website?
Or like something they can, even if they're at the museum, that they can somehow access.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely going to happen. The website is being completely redesigned and adding more specific content regarding what exhibits are accessible and how and where they are is definitely a part of that.
Have you tested different things as far as trying to help people get around the museum that just haven't worked well?
They have tested various things. At one point they had those talking signs. They've been at this since the late 80s. They've tried a whole variety of different wayfinding strategies. We just had a major sort of accessibility assessment of the entire museum. Wayfinding was definitely a major issue, and they didn't have any good solutions either. You know, as of yet, there really aren't any good solutions there. The system that Disney uses is actually in place at Patriot Place.
Patriot Place.
Yeah, and having gone and used it, it sucked. It really did. The way that system that Disney uses, and that it was actually developed by Disney, and they actually then licensed the technology and has been put in place in a variety of museums around the country, and it's now at Patriot Place. They don't use the GPS feature of it because all of their exhibits are internal. What they use are infrared, and one of the problems is as you move from area to area, if you happen to miss the little hot spot, you're going to miss the tag. They conflict with one another, so you can, if you step 6 inches to the left, all of a sudden what you're listening to stops and you end up in another zone.
Yes.
You know, recording. It was very difficult.
Most people don't go to a museum to get totally stressed out.
That's the one thing that I recognize may be necessary some of the time, but I resent having to do a day-long research project before I go somewhere. So I like to have something, even if it were as simple. One thing I used to say to people at the Museum of Science when I would go with my kids is, even if you had just in this at the same level, so I'd know where to find it on the wall, even if you had signs that just said what was on a particular floor as you came off up the stairs or off the elevator or whatever, just a sign that said, on this floor are the following exhibits, just so you'd know.
Just something simple.
I'm not looking for something elaborate with multi-page directions and whatever. I mean, I'll ask people.
Are we talking about a Braille sign?
Well, a Braille sign, yeah, a Braille sign is going to work for some people. Mm-hmm. A large print sign is going to work for some people. You know, that's the kind of basic access I'm talking about. I mean, I think there's a lot that the museum could do, even if you develop something that would be available at the desk as you signed in, you know, as you had passed in your tickets, that would say, okay, we have accessible exhibits here, here, and here.
You also need to consider lighting factors for low vision people.
So if your paper ticket had a barcode and you stuck it in the machine and then you said, I want English, I want Spanish, I want audio on, off, I want large print, and then every time you go to a different screen, stick in your ticket and then all the screens are wired together, it knows who you are and it instantly sets up the screen to your preferences.
That's one of the great opportunities if every visitor has a piece they can carry along. And one of the main things we're investigating with that is having a specific login, which would be a wristband or a ticket or something along those lines that is a barcode and does allow you to store some information between experiences. We're still evaluating what that is, but that's certainly...
So it would be a separate barcode thing that we're looking at for this particular experience.
Are you going to have human speech for this, or are you going to have some kind of speech synthesis?
It's a similar problem, even with pre-recorded human speech. You can still essentially run the same algorithm on it by increasing the speed of the speech, but maintaining pitch. Essentially what happens in creative advertisements and everything else all the time. So if that feature becomes something that really helps a lot of people, then it's something we could investigate regardless of whether it's a screen reader or recorded human speech.
I would say that's a really important feature, the ability to adjust the speech.
Yeah.
You know, one of the other experiences most of us have had here is using the voting machines. And I'll tell you, if I hadn't been able to speed up that damn voting machine, I would have been, you know, about ready to jump out a window. Because the thing at its generic was so slow, it was driving me nuts.
One thing to say about that is a lot of blind users that have been used, while they make it go really fast. People who aren't used to that, you know,
right,
they think where it's slow and it's a little bit faster that it's really fast, but it's usually slow for us. People who have hearing problems too, they hear different tones, and some of them, you know, they can hear better a woman's voice or a man's voice,
yeah,
high tones, low tones. That should be taken into consideration too.
And I guess that's my question is, are there questions you have that we've not addressed? Are there things that you would have liked to have gotten from this that you haven't received from us?
As we've all said, we're early in the process, so you've given us a lot of food for thought, not only for this particular interface, but other things as we're thinking about through the exhibit. One thing is, if people are interested, we're going to continue to do user testing for this exhibit and for other exhibits. So if people are interested in coming into the museum using prototypes as they're further along, we're always looking for more people to do that. So if
you can send me an email that indicates what the process you want is for people to self identify for that, I will send it to the group, and then not only the people who are here today, but also people who weren't able to come today. And then you can collect whatever data you need for your user database. But I'm sure there are a good number of us who'd be happy to come in and play.
And I just also want to commend you guys for coming and getting feedback from the blind community, because I think ultimately the reality is things are moving to touchscreen, and I think it's great that you guys are coming to us asking for feedback with accessibility in mind versus designing it and then trying to go backwards to incorporate accessibility.
Thank you all very much for sharing
Thank
some
you.
Of your Saturday
Thank
afternoon
you.
With us. It's been incredibly valuable.
Great. And to us as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.